This Janet Meffer Today podcast is sponsored by the Stand Against Marxism Conference, hosted by the Enemies Within the Church Project. Join us October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa, for the Stand Against Marxism Conference. Register now. More information is available at standagainstmarxism.com. That's standagainstmarxism.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Hey, everybody. Great to have you with us again. I'm going to kick things off here talking about this Faith and Healthy Democracy poll. Did you see this from Lifeway in conjunction with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention? It's kind of funny to me when I look at different websites what the emphasis is on reporting the results of this poll. It just shows you where they're coming from. Let's see. The headline in Christianity Today is this: is racial justice becoming a priority for evangelical voters? They asked, hopefully. Then you have the Christian Post. Their headline was, evangelicals more concerned about healthcare, economy than religious liberty and abortion, poll. So they're focused on what evangelicals think about various public policy issues. But this one was my favorite. This was from Baptist Press's website. ERLC report seeks to promote civility in U.S. The ERLC is going to promote civility. I'm sorry, I'm choking a little bit on the irony here. Why do I say this? Well, because it wasn't that long ago that 2016 was the year of Russell Moore taking on not only Donald Trump, but taking on anybody who voted for him, who bore the name evangelical. And it was just one long rant bashing evangelicals right and left. You've lost all your principles. I don't even want to be called an evangelical anymore. Talked about Donald Trump being, you know, fostering an atmosphere of bigotry and hate. And, you know, you remember, it wasn't that long ago. And he's going to tell us how to be civil and improve public discourse. Oh, man, it's an ironic laugh. Let me go to the Baptist Press story, though, so I can fill you in on what this report is all about. This is a report examining how evangelical Christians might help in healing America's political and cultural divides. It was just issued by the ERLC. Faith and Healthy Democracy is an account of what an ERLC-led research team learned from interviews with nearly 50 evangelical thought leaders and a Lifeway research survey of more than 1,300 evangelicals. 50 evangelical thought leaders. Yeah, I could make a joke about that, but I'm not going to. The ERLC plans on it being the first of many steps in the next year to help foster civility among Americans, because that's what we need. Why don't you talk to the left? Can I just say, why don't you aim your civility talk at Antifa? That might be a good place for you to talk about civility, as they're blocking little old ladies with walkers in the streets and throwing bottles and setting fires. Could we talk about that and hitting people in the head and making them bleed? Or you can talk about the nasty impeachment fever that is just growing and growing and growing, which is, to many people's minds, nothing more than a very thinly painted attempt at a coup of the United States government, with President Trump at the helm, having failed with the Russian collusion narrative. They immediately go on to Plan B. Or was it Plan C? Maybe it was Plan... What plan are we up to now? Why don't we talk about the left and its civility? At any rate, let me continue. The report assesses the condition of public discourse in the United States, analyzes evangelical positions on various issues, and offers some initial recommendations for strengthening civility. ERLC President Russell Moore said he praised the Lifeway survey and ERLC report would be among many initiatives that can help show us the way forward and help us learn to love one another and stand with courage in the public square. Did you ever apologize, by the way, to President Trump? President Trump was, remember before the election, he had tweeted out Russell Moore was a nasty man with no heart. Has he ever made up with President Trump? I don't know. Somebody needs to press him on that. The 49 evangelical leaders interviewed for the report agreed unanimously that American public discourse is dead. Dead? They used such words as corrosive, demoralizing, dysfunctional, hostile, inflammatory, and polarized to describe the state of the public conversation, according to the report written by lead researcher Paul Miller, professor of the practice of international affairs at Georgetown. He's also a Southern Baptist and an ERLC Research Institute fellow. The report says, tellingly, the single most common adjective our interviewees used was toxic. something that is actively poisonous and unhealthy even to be near. Such a situation is dangerous because we should engage in the public square. If the public square is toxic and unhealthy, okay, fewer will participate than should, while those who do will be sickened by it. All right, now the cynic in me is reading this, and I'm reading between the lines, because with the ERLC, you always have to read between the lines. Always. Nothing is what they say it is. It's always something else. Okay? So when they're talking about the public square being toxic and unhealthy, fewer will participate than should, while those who do will be sickened by it. Is this a thinly veiled attempt to try to get out the vote to vote against Trump in 2020? I'm just asking the question. I don't know. But all I know is it wasn't that long ago that you had all these evangelical thought leaders assembling in Wheaton behind closed doors. I jokingly referred to them as the Bilderberg Group. And they were meeting behind closed doors and they were thinking about ways that they could deal with, you know, the problems of Trump. And then they denied they talked about Trump, even though people who were there at the meeting said that they talked about Trump. So if it's the same crowd, and I would imagine there's probably some overlap between that meeting in Wheaton and this particular survey, then I don't really care. That, I mean, it sounds terrible. It sounds terrible. I'm not trying to impugn people across the board, but we have so much corruption. We have so much liberalism. We have so much rank progressivism and social justice, you know, warrioring. That's not even a word, but social justice pushing in evangelicalism. These guys are the tip of the spear trying to get leftist Marxist thought into evangelical churches. And I don't care what they think, really. I don't care. I would agree, actually, to be fair, I would agree that there is a toxic, corrosive component to public discourse, but I would lay the blame largely at the feet of the left. Go after the left. You know, it's conservatives who are being shut down by big tech. It's conservatives who are having their videos ripped down off sites like Vimeo, like happened to our God's Voice conference. It's Christians who are being sued by homosexual couples because they don't want to engage in promoting speech that violates their Christian faith. And I don't see all these evangelical thought leaders going nuts about that stuff and Christians being on the receiving end of totalitarian activity or censorship. I don't recall Russell Moore and all of his evangelical thought leader buddies getting very upset about the fact that Amazon took down all of these books that had to deal with leaving homosexuality. And it was all spearheaded by a gay activist who put enormous pressure on Amazon to just spike the books. He had never read the books. He didn't read any of those books. Joe Dallas, Ann Polk, Joseph Nicolosi. He didn't read any of those books. He just wanted to silence dissent against homosexuality. And I don't see any kind of worrisome, you know, hand wringing over that. That's why it bugs me, because they're never really about what needs to be talked about. They're not really ever emphasizing the key issue of the moment. They want to set the narrative. They want to set the agenda in a leftist direction. And so anytime there actually is a crisis that doesn't fit with their political narrative, they change the subject. Have you ever noticed that? They change the subject. They might tip the hat now and then to some issue with which we can all agree, such as abortion or religious liberty, but it's always kind of tepid. It's kind of tepid. You know, you had Russell Moore lecturing the United States on what it ought to be doing in China on the issue of religious liberty, and he never once gives credit to President Trump for standing up at the UN and introducing some very vital initiatives for making sure that religious liberty is protected. He doesn't get any kudos for that. So just keep in mind the political operative stuff that's going on here. By the way, if you flip to the back of this Baptist Press story on this whole thing, it says that they worked with the Fetzer Institute. The Fetzer Institute. This is an institute founded in conjunction with this John Fetzer. John Fetzer was a big time New Ager. What are you doing? Well, they try to kind of take attention away from that. And they say, well, you know, we're not a Christian organization, but we all care about discourse in the public square. What, was Barna not available? You couldn't go to anybody else except the Fetzer Institute? At any rate, this is just what it is. This is what it is. Oh, and in the Christianity Today story, I thought this was quite interesting. Toward the end of that story, there is a very interesting line when it talks about the results of this poll. And by the way, it was the case that among evangelicals surveyed in this poll, the top three issues were not religious liberty or abortion. They were health care and the economy and national security. So who knows? But at the end of this, they talk about how to achieve civility. And one of the suggestions was avoid frequent engagement in social media about political and social issues. Oh, I bet you want us to do that. No, keep the conservatives quiet. Shh, don't talk about it. Shh, just keep it down. Keep it down over there on social media. No, go out there and tweet to your heart's content. Go on Facebook. Go on any of these social media sites where you can get the truth out. You go for it. It's perfectly civil to me. We're going to come back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. It may be hard for Americans to believe, but there are many people in Lebanon who have never heard anything about Jesus. That's exactly why Heart for Lebanon is there, working in the nation that's currently home to more than 2 million Syrian refugee families who have been displaced through no fault of their own. Every day, Heart for Lebanon is reaching out to these families in Jesus' name, telling them about Him, and providing food, Christian education, and survival essentials. And the Lord is changing lives. One little girl will call Shayna was one of those refugee kids who had never heard of Jesus until she entered Heart for Lebanon's educational program. When Shayna was given the assignment to write about a defining moment in her life, she chose to write this. We were in Syria and we knew nothing about Christ the Lord. When we came to Lebanon, I joined Heart for Lebanon school. It is there where I got to know that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world and that He can save my sins and that whosoever worships Him will have eternal life. And you know what? Shayna learned who Jesus was because someone here in the United States supported the important work of Heart for Lebanon. And you can support them too. Right now, you can help rescue a child like Shayna and her family with food, Christian education, and survival essentials for just 98 cents a day. That's just $29 a month to rescue a family of six. Call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. These families need immediate help. And more than that, they need Jesus Christ and they need to hear the gospel that can save. Please help the important work of Heart for Lebanon today. Again, that number is 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you so much for whatever you can do. And God bless you. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. What is the state of pro-life legislation across the country? Well, Americans United for Life has just released its 2019 state legislative report showing that it's been a banner year for the pro-life cause. So far in 2019, 58 life-affirming laws have passed and were signed across 22 states, representing a more than 25% increase from 2018. We're going to get some more details now from Katie Glenn, who serves as Government Affairs Counsel at Americans United for Life. Katie, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. I love good news. This is great, especially when it comes to the pro-life cause. It has been a banner year. Can you tell people a little bit about the details and why that is?
Yes, we are so excited to share this report that took many, many hours to compile. There were over 570 pro-life bills filed across all across 46 states. So just about everywhere in the United States, legislators were looking at thinking about pro-life legislation. And fortunately, as you mentioned, 58 of those passed and were signed into law. So a really great ratio to get 10% of those bills across the finish line and passed in various states. And it's getting us excited as we go into 2020.
That is exciting. So for those that actually made it all the way through and were signed into law, what were some of the most notable pieces of legislation?
Well, of course, the legislation that I think got the most coverage was some of the heartbeat bills, the law in Alabama, the law in Georgia, Missouri, a couple of other states that really stood up. They looked at the very extreme New York law that would permit abortion all the way through a pregnancy, and they said, not in our state. Yep. And they chose to go in the opposite direction to limit abortion much sooner. In most states that pass these kinds of laws around heartbeat, which is about 7 or 8 weeks. But then we also saw a lot of other types of bills that did things like protect infants that are born alive. That's one of the bills that Texas passed this year. We saw five states pass laws about reporting that women who are receiving or who are having an abortion receive information before that procedure, if it's a chemical abortion, explaining to them that that chemical abortion has the possibility of reversal and how to get that process started if they regret their chemical abortion. And so that's the kind of thing that, you know, state legislators really have a role to play in making sure that we are protecting infants everywhere that we can, and we are also providing women with all the information that we possibly can.
Well, that's wonderful. When you're talking about the heartbeat bills, one of the things that interests me, and I know a lot of listeners will agree with this, is the momentum that may or may not be out there for further passage of heartbeat bills in other states. What is the status on that? Can you tell us?
Well, right now, all of the heartbeat bills are currently going, they're tied up in the courts. They're at various stages of litigation, and there are about 40 cases across the United States in the lower courts related to heartbeat and other types of pro-life legislation. So we have not heard the last of this for sure. I think that there are many legislators who are going to use 2020 as sort of a wait and see year to see what happens with those court cases, to see if the Supreme Court ends up taking one of those cases even. And then it will be, I think, full steam ahead to pass more bills.
Well, I hope so. And of course, the biggest victory that you guys point out is the national abortion rate continues its trend downward. It's now at the lowest rate since Roe v. Wade, which I think a lot of Americans didn't know. Why is that the case? To what do you attribute that downward trend? What do you think is helping the most to, you know, put that number downward instead of upward?
Well, there are a couple of theories, and it very much depends on who you ask what they will say. We like to cite Dr. Michael New, who's a professor at Catholic University. He's done a lot of research on this, and what he sees are the big things are pro-life legislation, these informed consent laws that help women better understand what abortion really is, as well as the growing number of pregnancy care centers out there, the resources that they provide.
Right.
And that as we have better science and technology, especially with related to ultrasound, that more and more Americans are identifying as pro-life. They are seeing the unborn as human unborn babies worthy of protection under our laws. And so fewer women are making the choice to have an abortion.
And that's wonderful. We want that to continue. Well, and the fact that we've seen so many abortion clinics close down in recent years must be having a big effect as well. How much of an effect? Do we have any notion on that score?
Well, it definitely is something where it both obviously if a clinic closes down, then there is not that clinic in that community. And it's an opportunity for care centers to step up and really care for those women who are having unplanned pregnancies still. But it's also an opportunity. It really shines a light on what's going on at these clinics and when they are violating health and safety regulations, like just how dirty and dangerous these facilities really are. I know we have been carefully watching, and I'm sure you have too, the story coming out of Illinois and Indiana with Klopfer,
yes,
the former doctor who was an abortionist in the state of Indiana for many years. And it took over 2,000 complaints filed against him before his medical license was suspended.
Wow.
So having laws that provide transparency, that require reporting out of these clinics, make it so it's less likely that that kind of thing can happen or can go on for as long as it did in his case and in the case of many other abortionists.
Yeah, and it kind of flew in the face this notion that Gosnell was an outlier, that his House of Horrors in Philadelphia, that was just a one-time thing. No other abortionist would ever do anything like that. And like you said, then all these remains of babies were discovered on Klopfer's property after his death. It's just maybe that also is contributing to the pro-life numbers and some of the, you know, impetus behind getting some of these laws passed from a public perspective. They see these stories and they say, this is ghoulish. This is evil. And perhaps, even though it's a horrible thing, in the long run, it may help PR for the pro-life cause.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't tell you how many times I heard Did you hear what Governor Ralph Northam said in Virginia about babies born alive?
Yes.
That is not what we want in our state. And many states took on, I saw one state, they had a campaign called #NotNewYork, where they wanted to step up and say, New York is passing this very extreme law. We want to do something different in our state. And so I think every time we have a case like that of, you know, Governor Northam being a little too honest about what he means about born alive babies, or the exposure of the fetuses in Klopfer's garage, it's an opportunity for us to say, this is what we're talking about.
Yes.
This is what abortion is. And more people are going to see that, are going to see that that's not something they support.
Yeah, that's good. A good point. Well, you guys have model legislation, the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, which passed actually, right, in a couple of states?
Yes, yes. It passed this year in Arkansas and Texas.
That's great. 48 to go. I love that. Yeah, keep working. That's good. And what about these other states that passed laws limiting abortion on the contingency that if Roe v. Wade were overturned, they would kick in? What's going on that front?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of legislators right now are really feeling like the day that Roe v. Wade is overturned is coming. They feel like it's a when, not an if anymore, with the current makeup of the Supreme Court as it is. And so they're really getting ready to plan for that. And there are several different strategies. As you mentioned, the conditional laws, where a state either adds to their state constitution or passes legislation that says, if federal law changes or if the court overturns Roe v. Wade, here's what we are going to have our laws look like. And it's going to be not the Roe v. Wade standard of abortion all the way up to the end of pregnancy. It's going to be 8 weeks with heartbeat. It's going to be 14 weeks was one we saw this year. Missouri really threw out several numbers, hoping one of them will be upheld by the courts. And so it's really about legislators thinking of this as this is going to happen soon. And on that day, we want our laws to look a certain way, and we want them to have abortion either not at all be available under our law, or be available under extremely rare conditions, such as when the mother's health is at risk or her life is at risk. So this is really about legislators preparing for a day that we all hope comes very soon.
Oh, yeah. Another thing I want to mention, because this is also an issue that I think is going to be on the rise ever more so in the coming years, and that is this issue of physician-assisted suicide. I know that you guys have publicly opposed these bills that popped up across the country on that issue. Where does that stand? What is the trend right now concerning physician-assisted suicide?
Well, in 2019, 18 states considered legislation that would permit suicide by a physician. Fortunately, only two of those passed. It's something that we at Americans United for Life are extremely concerned about. I would expect, unfortunately, to see that many states or more introduce this again in 2020.
Yes.
And we will continue to oppose that everywhere that we can.
Do you see any more bills coming up in the immediate future regarding physician-assisted suicide?
Well, we just submitted written testimony against a bill that's being considered in Minnesota. So that is the one that's had the most recent action. There was a hearing about 2 weeks ago in Minnesota on a suicide bill. And in that case, they basically, their law preventing suicide by a physician was recently upheld by their state Supreme Court. Less than 2 years ago, and there are still forces in that state who want to, go against what the court said and repeal their existing law and add the availability of suicide by physician.
Yeah, that's just awful. We don't want that to happen. I'm so glad that you guys are all over this, because we need you on the pro-life front, not just with physician-assisted suicide, but obviously with all this great pro-life legislation. You can check out more at Americans United for Life's website, aul.org. Katie Glenn, thank you so much for the update. Keep up the good work. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by the Stand Against Marxism Conference, hosted by the Enemies Within the Church Project. Join us October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa, for the Stand Against Marxism Conference. Register now. More information is available at standagainstmarxism.com. That's standagainstmarxism.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Back in 2014, the New York Times ran an article reflecting on the life of Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple. And when a reporter asked Jobs if his kids love the new iPad, he said this: "They haven't used it. We limit how much technology our kids use at home." Now, that's pretty mind-blowing that one of the big tech giants was astute enough to recognize the need to protect his own kids from the power of technology, even as he was inflicting it on the rest of the world. But what does that mean for us? And as Christians, how can we break free from the power of screens to reclaim our thought lives and fulfill what the Lord has for us to do in real life? We're going to talk about it today with Doug Smith, who is author of Unintentional: How Screens Secretly Shape Your Desires and How You Can Break Free. Doug, it's great to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Jana. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you have a lot of experience, I understand, with web programming, so you know something of technology. When did you begin to become concerned about the problem of screen immersion?
Oh, thank you for asking. I've been a web developer for almost as long as the internet's been around, for
wow,
more than 20 years. But my biggest concerns came as a dad of four daughters, as I watched, my own girls facing, the increasing influence of screens in their lives. And that was before smartphones. But as I saw this, after the release of the smartphone, things really, really ramped up. And that was hard to remember. It was only 10 years ago, roughly, 2007, 2008. So what happened is I just started noticing everyone's on their screens all the time. What is up with that? And it really concerned me, especially as a Christian as well, because I was seeing Christian people. I was going to church, and instead of listening to the sermon, there's someone on their phone.
Yep.
It's like, what is going on? So it started a quest for me back in 2014 is when it really struck me that I needed to start speaking out on the subject.
Oh, I'm so glad that you are, because there's so much good material in this book. I think everybody needs to know what you're advocating here and what you're schooling people on. Talk a little bit about the addiction factor. I know there has been some news about that. And from time to time, they talk about, how these companies actually intentionally try to get you addicted so you'll keep coming back, things like social media and so forth. But speak a little bit, if you would, to the power of addiction to screens and why we get addicted. Because I think for a lot of people, they don't really understand, why do I have this insatiable desire to check my phone every 5 seconds?
Right. And that's the critical factor, Janet, is that it is intentional on the part of the industry. Their business model is all based on how much we use their quote unquote free apps, the free apps that they provide for us. So it is a bona fide addiction. And the more anytime you go down a rabbit hole and you dig into the research, you can find, wow, there's so much intentionality. The largest tech companies hire top behavioral psychologists and neuroscientists. They do thousands and thousands of tests to figure out what is the thing that keeps us hooked the longest. And it's all about exploiting essentially weaknesses in our behavioral psychology and the chemical makeup of our brain. And we can go pretty deep into that. But for example, the neurotransmitter dopamine is a, I call it the elixir of our brain's pleasure system. And it can be triggered not only by, substances that we sometimes think about. We think of a drug addict. Well, that gets the dopamine cycle going in the brain. The pleasure cycle gets it overloaded and causes us to crave more of that same pleasure. Well, things on screens do the same thing. The like buttons, the endless scrolling, I wonder if somebody commented, all of those kinds of things and the quick access to it and hundreds of more are all, again, intentionally designed by top people that their whole job is to get us using and to get us thinking about what's the next thing that I need to be looking at on my phone as like the top of mind thing whenever I'm bored, whenever I need to be distracted, and so on. So it's very intentional on the industry's part.
Yeah, it sure is. Is that more the case, would you say, on social media than anywhere else, or is it equally addictive in other sectors?
I think social media is probably the big poster child, but video games are also very significant.
Yes.
Especially the, well, then they have a social component, right? I mean, right. Many parents of boys of a certain age especially have heard of Fortnite. That one, according to a new friend of mine who's a clinical psychologist, says there's, Dr. Richard Fried says there's actually 200 specific exploits of your behavioral psychology in Fortnite alone.
Mm.
So yeah, it's probably those are the main ones, but I also, bring out pornography, and pornography is a direct dopamine target. So there's a habitual addictive factor to pornography in addition to the Christian sin aspect to that as well. So,
yeah.
And of course the porn industry anywhere from can go up to like some measures say like 30% of the internet is consumed with that kind of traffic. So
those are
like the big three in my mind.
Yeah. Now, when you mention the pleasure center of your brain and they know how to trigger it and get you addicted and that sort of thing, what else? Are there other things we need to be aware of? Because I think the dopamine, a lot of people have heard that, but are there other ways too that they get you addicted to technology and you just have to keep going back to your phone? You have to keep going back to that game. Are there other things that they're doing that we're not aware of?
I think one of the things that a lot of people aren't aware of is how much data is collected about us.
Mm.
We hear about, we hear about privacy concerns, and we hear, we know that, for example, Facebook and Google has tons and tons of data, but I think most people don't realize the vast amounts of the constant communication that our devices are having. They know, how long we linger over a certain post. They know what videos we like and if we'll watch the whole thing. So they know what's next. They know what to show us next.
Hmm.
And so they use our data, they use the knowledge they have about us against us by targeting the things that keep us hooked. So whenever we open our app, we're pleasantly surprised to find something that we were hoping to find there.
Yeah, that's
true. And that is because they know more about us than we know about ourselves in many cases.
Yeah, we're happy to see it and simultaneously creeped out. At least that's my reaction half the time. How did YouTube know? Yeah, how did YouTube know that I would want to see this video? That's creepy.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Well, yet for kids, this is what's interesting, Doug, and I'm sure you've encountered this, but for kids, their reaction to, hey, listen, this is going on. They know how to manipulate you and they know how to get you coming back. A lot of kids will just say, so what? I don't care. It's fun. I like being on social media. I like interacting with my friends. What do you say to those kids on why that addiction is bad for you and why you need to come up with ways to not be so addicted to technology?
Yeah, that's a really deep conversation there. I think for me as a Christian dad, it really starts with the parents setting a culture in your home about what we're here for. What are we here to do? What are we on this planet to do? And so setting a context with our kids about, are we here to provide free data to the biggest corporations in the industry? for the rest of our lives? Are we the equivalent? Are we here to work the equivalent of a full-time job for free, looking at advertisements and playing the latest thing just because it feels good?
Hmm.
So that's one part of it. Another aspect is, if you can have a deep conversation with a child or a teen, most of them don't want to be tricked or lied to.
Yeah.
So I like to work that angle as well. Like, did you understand? Like, I know this feels good. I know it really feels good to play those games. Or to be on that social media, but at the end of the day, did you know that it's designed to keep you that way?
Hmm.
And so playing that angle as far as the idea that this is intentionally luring you. I think of the old movie Pinocchio, where Pinocchio is led by his friends to go play on Pleasure Island, I think it was.
Yep.
And it's all fun, yay, until they turn them into donkeys and send them to salt mines. It's that kind of imagery I have. When you wake up one day and you've spent 10,000 hours mastering a video game and you have no other skills,
oh.
That's not where we want our kids to be.
So true. What time wasted also is part of the equation. We waste so much time doing this. What have you really got to show for it at the end of the day? And there's also a spiritual dimension that you mentioned that underlies this entire thing. We'll come back and talk about that with Doug Smith. His book is called Unintentional: How Screens Secretly Shape Your Desires and How You Can Break Free. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. There's been a leftist takeover within conservative Christianity. Ungodly socialist ideas are coming to prominence. Ideas like social justice, critical race theory, and cultural Marxism. And leading figures within mainstream evangelicalism are showing themselves to be untrustworthy as shepherds and guardians of the truth. If you're a Christian who wants to know what to do about this serious shift away from biblical truth, then I invite you to join me at the upcoming Stand Against Marxism conference, taking place October 18th and 19th. In Des Moines, Iowa. Hosted by the Enemies Within the Church Project, the Stand Against Marxism conference will inform you about this dangerous infiltration of postmodern thought, connect you with other concerned Christians, and teach you how to defend biblical Christianity in your own church. Register now for the Stand Against Marxism conference, October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa. For more information, you can visit standagainstmarxism.com. That's standagainstmarxism.com. See you there. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Do you ever get to the end of an hour or two on your smartphone and say, boy, that was a waste of time. Why did I spend such a long time on social media today? Or maybe you're saying it about your kids. Well, there are reasons that you can become addicted to your screen. And we're talking with Doug Smith about his book that covers this subject, Unintentional: How Screens Secretly Shape Your Desires and How You Can Break Free. Doug, you mentioned in your book, as I teased before that last break, that there is a spiritual dimension that also underlies what is going on with this screen addiction. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I sure can, Janet. And that was one of the things that I think surprised me as I really dug into it, the case for the spiritual dimension, the spiritual warfare dimension of the things that are going on. As Christians, you know, we are taught in the scriptures, and Jesus modeled very many times, that there is an unseen battle. There are things going on. And the key aspect that I found is this idea that in John 10:10, Jesus says that the devil is a liar and the father of lies.
Yep.
So anytime we're lied to, any the source of a lie, that you can trace it back to the father of lies. And so I looked at that and I thought, okay, is there something? I mean, is there the irony that the enemy is referred to as the prince of the power of the air,
right,
and that all these things are coming over the air? To me, the more I dug into it, the more I thought, this is not a coincidence. It's too effective. It's worldwide. It affects Christians and non-Christians almost, you know, at the same rate. And where is it taking us? Well, it's leading us into ideas that are not biblical. It's leading us to think not biblically. It's leading us to not be able to even like have 5 seconds to pray. You know, if these things like, you know, if we can't have quiet moments and hear a still small voice, like all these things are specifically targeted against the very things that really make us able to walk with God on a day-by-day basis. And that's got to be a strategy. There's got to be something behind it. It works too well. It's not an accident. And so I make the case in chapter 4 that I it's relatively bold, but I think there is a spiritual dimension to it, and I think the evidence is pretty clear.
I think so, too. Do you see that, for example, in some of these statistics that have come out about people increasingly not reading their Bibles? I mean, you mentioned smartphones, and people take their smartphones out at church, and you don't hear the pages turning the way you used to. People aren't bringing their physical Bibles, in some cases, the way they used to. Is that part of it? Do you see that as you're addicted to your smartphone, you have less of an attention span for sitting down in many cases and reading many pages of scripture, for example, in the morning?
Absolutely, yeah. The attack on our attention span is tremendous. And as we know, anyone who studied the scripture for any length of time knows it's a complicated book, and it takes effort. It takes the ability to keep a concept in your head for longer than, 9 seconds, the time a goldfish swims around its little goldfish.
Right.
So the targeting of our attention span is a huge detriment to our ability to understand the scriptures, to pay attention to a message, to really even think clearly. And that's one of the heartbreaking things as I just realized what was going on. And our inability to think clearly, it goes really at the heart of who we are, our identity. Yeah. If we aren't free to think our own thoughts or to hear from God, then, we've lost something tremendous about who he's made us to be.
Well, that's a really important point. How do you think users can evaluate themselves to see if screens have become too addictive? How do you know if you're too addicted? What would be, some of the ways that you could evaluate that?
Well, that's a great question. I happen to have a questionnaire for anyone who's interested. I have a website called How I Am I, which is I for intentional, so howiami.com. And people go there, they can download my free assessment. And it just asks a lot of questions about things that you may not realize. There are many ways to look at it because most people just aren't aware. Again, the statistics show that the average is anywhere from 6 to up to 12 hours a day, depending on the study, of engagement with media on various screens. Mm-hmm. And we get that from multitasking. We get up to the 12-hour figure by, scrolling Facebook while we're watching TV or something. But at the end of the day, we didn't set out to do that. And so, as we know, smartphones have come out recently with apps like Screen Time. And so it'll tell us, at least at that level, if we use that app, how much we're using it each week. But, then there's all the other screens in our lives as well. So I really encourage people to take a deep look, a deep self-evaluation, and really line that up then with where you hope your life would be by now.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, because when we're talking about screens, we're not just talking about the internet or smartphones. We're also talking about things like TV. I mean, you say in the book, you've taken cable out of your home. I think that's a great idea. Yeah. We've done the same thing. I don't want to be looking. There's so much garbage on TV. Why do I need it?
Absolutely. It's not. And again, it's for me, it's so much of what I get known for is what I'm saying no to. But at the end of the day, it's what we're saying yes to instead. We're here for a purpose. God's made us for a reason. The world is very needy, and there's lots of things we should be doing besides, again, spending, 30, 40 hours a week watching entertainment screens on one thing or another. Again, we don't set out to do that, but if we look back over our lives, we go, wow, I wish I could have helped so-and-so. I wish I could have learned this. I wish I could have, at the end of the day, I want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant.
Right.
That's what I'm here for. So when I think about that, cable doesn't fit that equation.
Yeah, that's such a good point. So when you're talking about applying biblical practices in order to combat your screen addiction, the first one you mention is surrendering to Jesus Christ. How does this fit? People say, well, I thought I was surrendered to Jesus Christ. How does that really fit with my addiction to Facebook or my addiction to Twitter? What do you mean by that, Doug?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Yeah, that is the fundamental starting point in terms of the biblical practices that I recommend that people apply in their lives to be able to walk in intentional freedom. So when we think about surrender, for me, surrender is a day-by-day, even moment-by-moment, because we might surrender one thing and think we're good, but if we're open, then we pray that really dangerous prayer, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any wicked way in me and lead me in your everlasting way. That's a pretty open prayer, and there's always something. So the thing about surrender in regard to our screens is that it's a very different conversation than the culture typically has, which is usually around a word, the word we love to use is balance. Mm-hmm. We love to say, you just need balance with your technology, you know, don't, you know, and I'm not advocating people become Amish by any means, but I am advocating that the word balance is really a troublesome word because we're all balanced in our own eyes. I'm the most balanced person I know. I often tell people. So, and you know, so it's all you all, you know, it's all y'all that are, you know, they're off on one tangent or another. Right. But anyway, all the ways of a right man are right in his own eyes. So, but the Lord tests the heart. So, surrender, starting from Lord, where what role should screens have in my life, and being really willing to hear an answer that may be a lot less than you're doing right now. That's really where it comes from, and being willing to say, Lord, I surrender this to you. I surrender this device to you. I surrender it even to the point of giving it up if I have to, depending on what people are tempted by on various screens. They may need to take a really, really long break or do something really different, very countercultural.
Right. I mean, you say that even some people shouldn't even have a smartphone. And I'm sure everybody will say, well, that's the other guy. That's not me. And I certainly don't need to get rid of my smartphone. That's the guy next door who has a problem with it.
Absolutely. And yeah, when I speak on that, I can hear the air go out of the room when I say that. What? You know, some people may not have a sound phone, you know, a smartphone, and kids, I'm like, my kids shouldn't have a smartphone. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. No. And again, but the point is, you know, they've only been around 10 years. Why have they become an extra limb?
Right.
They've become an extra because of an intentional design that are leading you off track. So we have to be willing to ask that question and say, you know, I'm here for you, Lord, not for the biggest corporations in the world. Where does this fit in my life? And a lot of people can have some, but I've talked to guys, especially that trying to break free from, you know, online addictions, porn or whatever, and they just need to have a flip phone right now. And until that tentacles from those addictions are totally, you know, broken free, and then maybe they can introduce it with some certain boundaries around it.
I think that makes a lot of sense, whether it's just fasting from a social media site for a while or deleting your account or, like you say, just get rid of the smartphone and get a flip phone. Go back to talking on the phone. I know this will send the kids nuts. Talking on phones, I can't text that way. You know how they go. Yeah, but really, really good advice. Again, the name of the book is Unintentional, How Screens Secretly Shape Your Desires and How You Can Break Free by Doug Smith, who's been kind enough to join us today, and we're delighted you did. Doug, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be with you today.
Oh, it's my honor. Thanks again, Doug. Appreciate your being here, and God bless. Well, thank you so much for tuning in to Janet Mefford today. As always, we appreciate your being with us, and we'll see you next time. God bless you.